time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Dr. Steve Gilbert, Nancy Dickman, and Diane Dickman. Dr. Stephen Gilbert is the president of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. He is also director of the Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders. And Nancy Dickman and Diane Dickman are both co-curators of Particles on the Wall, a multidisciplinary exhibit exploring Hanford history, landscape, and nuclear issues. And that's what we're going to be discussing this morning. Steve, Diane, and Nancy, thank you all for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Let's start out with you, Steve. Tell us briefly about Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Well, the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility was founded in 1979 and is an organization, statewide organization of health professionals and a wide group of doctors, nurses, public health professionals, you know, engaged in looking at the gravest threats to health and the environment. We have several committees. We have an Environmental Justice and Human Health Committee that works on issues like greening hospitals, phthalates, endocrine disruptors, things that affect public health and child health-related issues. We have an Energy and Peace Committee that works on, for example, climate change, issues around health effects of coal production and coal as electrical power utility. And most importantly, we have a group that works on Hanford issues. And that's what we're talking about today, more of this Particles on the Wall and our efforts to engage the public. And part of that effort is a website called the Washington Nuclear Museum and Education Center, a virtual site that has information about Hanford and issues related to health of Hanford and the health effects of Hanford. And really, we're trying to look at the nuclear issues throughout Washington State, because Washington State's had enormous history of nuclear issues, including the Bangor submarine base, the largest concentration of nuclear weapons in the world.
So, yeah, from the creation of plutonium over at Hanford to Bangor.
Right.
See the full cycle here in the state.
And I think the state has a great opportunity to help people learn more about these issues and really engage the public in these issues and talk about this and lessons learned that will affect the worldwide use of nuclear weapons and our efforts to try to reduce nuclear weapons. That's one thing the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility does, is we try to come up with solutions to these problems and try to move us away from the use, manufacture of nuclear weapons.
All right. Now, you're actually all co-curators of Particles on the Wall. Nancy and Diane, can you tell us about what exactly Particles on the Wall is and how it came about?
Well, Particles on the Wall came about probably sometime last year with the initial meeting with Steve here and also with Bill Witherup, who passed away in June but was very active on Hanford issues, is also a Richland native and a poet. And it came about as a way to really fuse the arts and the sciences together as a more sort of passionate and effective way to sort of reach people's hearts and minds around issues. And this in particular is a way to merge the issues around nuclear concerns with art, and blending both visual art and written word as well as science and history and memorabilia.
And I came into the project after the initial formulating of the exhibit and the idea behind the exhibit to bring in visual art and also more of the Hanford history and memorabilia.
All right, Diane. So you're more of a visual artist?
I am.
And Nancy, you write.
I write. Poetry, but also I'm just finished a first novel manuscript that's set in Richland.
All right. And you both grew up in Richland. Can you talk a bit about that? What was that like growing up there?
It was a small town childhood, very quiet, very safe in terms of people were very trusting of their neighbors, of the whole community. Doors were not locked. Kids were allowed to roam probably for miles around the neighborhood. I mean, I just remember riding our bikes all over town. It was not any kind of concerns in that way. It was a very different time in terms of people's awareness of health issues. You know, I remember the kids in the neighborhood loving to chase the mosquito truck, which was, I'm sure, spewing DDT and on their bikes. And just a very probably typical in some ways small town growing up, but that whole atomic presence was there. The local movie theater was called the Atomic Theater and had the atomic energy symbol as part of its, you know, neon sign. And so it was always there. There was always that awareness. I remember in my grade school days going on a Brownie or Girl Scout, some type of group field trip, and we went around and looked at missile sites. That was one of the things that you did.
So, like the Nike missile,
right?
Sites,
right.
Supposedly for defense. And the whole reason you were there was because your father worked at some of the nuclear facilities. Is that correct?
Right, right. He was a nuclear engineer. Had finished his master's degree after coming out of the Army in World War II, and then I think pretty much immediately his first employment, I believe, was moving to Hanford. So my parents, who were both from the Midwest, you know, relocated to the Hanford area, and that's where we grew up.
It was also an era sort of great secrecy. One thing I remember our mom telling us about was that, you know, she was visited and her friends were visited by the FBI on occasion and would ask, you know, just check in and ask, you know, if there was anything unusual about, you know, what the neighbors were doing. And she told this story about one time a friend of hers had sort of congratulated her on our dad getting a promotion. And my mom was like, you know, was sort of feigning that, you know, she didn't know about a promotion. And the friend said, told her, well, Janice, it was in the Villager, so it's okay. So, I mean, it was just a very high level of secrecy and around that time and place.
You know, one of the things we're trying to do with the Washington Nuclear Museum and Education Center is capture some of these stories. So we encourage people to, you know, write little essays up about this or send us tape recordings of their stories about Hanford and what happened at Hanford and their impressions of Hanford, where they lived there, worked there, or had family members that were at Hanford during that period of time.
So the Washington Nuclear Museum and Educational Center, is that something that is a physical entity?
Right now, it's not a physical entity. It's virtual, and it's been partly funded by the Department of Ecology. The Washington State Department of Ecology has helped fund this as an outreach to people to learn more about Hanford. And we're hoping to actually turn it into an actual real museum. And we have a place in mind for this at the University of Washington. They have Moore Hall Annex, which is the site of a nuclear reactor at the University of Washington. And the building was just declared a national monument recently. And University of Washington, unfortunately, has been interested in tearing the building down to put up something else there. But what we like to do is turn it into an actual physical museum. It's an amazing building. I urge people to go take a look at that building. You actually could look down on the nuclear reactor in the building. So it's a perfect example of what we thought about nuclear energy and the atom in the 60s and 70s. That we are totally safe. You can't imagine building a nuclear reactor on a campus now, right in the middle of a city. But then we're building it not only in campus, but also making it perfectly public, and you could see the nuclear reactor. It's a really interesting building.
So that's during the same time when they had the Atoms for Peace program?
Yes, that was part of the Atoms for Peace program. Yeah, very good.
Exporting nuclear technology to places like Iran, and then saying later that
they actually have a stamp on that part of the Particles on the Wall exhibit, which is going to be at Cafe Allegro during January, and we have a reception on January 8th that we invite everybody to. I actually have a framed stamp, a first issue stamp of the Atoms for Peace program. Really interesting stuff.
Yeah, we should point out again that the Particles on the Walls, it actually starts tomorrow at Cafe Allegro, doesn't it?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Perhaps we can't really show anyone visuals of it over the radio, but Nancy, you have included some of the pieces that'll be up there. I'm wondering if perhaps you could share some of that with us.
Certainly. We're going to be including several of Bill Withrop's poems in the exhibit and a couple other local poets, Kathleen Flanagan, Tom Buchanan, and I'll have a poem included as well. And I could read a short poem that I have a poem up there that's called The Windsail, but I'm thinking There's also a poem called Reservation, which is related to sort of what went on at Hanford a little bit. So, Reservation. Driving past security, my father tipped his hat at the guard who waved him on. The badge on my father's chest worn, not to name authority, but to measure exposure, the point at which his daily risk might trip him up. When he drove the hills towards home, the desert turned under him, sage and sand ground to dust, rocks overtaken by a violet glow. All the while, minerals touched us, particulates combing the air and marking us, invisibly changed. In the dust storm, the desert stuck to me like silt, a line drawn around my mouth and nose. His back to me, his face pressed into the receiver, my father said the guards had orders to shoot to kill. What they held behind them was a question of life and death, the rods delicately working at the purest calculations, and the tower casting itself clean across the river, or reduced to powder, a golden substance diffusible as breath.
So let's talk a bit more about what actually was happening at Hanford. I don't think we've gone into that in proper detail. So it was created as part of the Manhattan Project, is that correct?
Part of the Manhattan Project. It started up in 1943 and actually came through, and it was called Site W, where they removed everybody from the site. They actually bought out. You had 30 days, and the government offered you X amount of money for your shop, your home, whatever it was. They cleared everybody out, brought in roughly 50,000 workers, and started building the first reactor. So the B reactor, the first reactor, it went critical, I think, in 1944, and it produced a plutonium that would for the Trinity bomb that was detonated, the first nuclear weapon that was detonated, and also produced the plutonium for the bomb that was dropped in Nagasaki. They went on to create multiple sites around the reach, and this would, they selected this site because it was remote, had lots of water to cool the reactors with, and it was out in the middle of no place. I mean, it was just a place where they felt like they could control the environment, and there was few enough people that they could get control of all the land and the water around that. And then they proceeded to build multiple sites and 8 reactors there eventually, all dedicated to producing plutonium for the Cold War and World War II. And this is part of the legacy that we have there. They have enormous number of tanks there where they put radioactive waste. A lot of these tanks are leaking now. There are 177 tanks, 149 of them were single-shelled tanks with a very limited lifespan. Many of them started leaking. They're now working, they're spending billions of dollars cleaning up the site. And that's one thing Washington Physicians Social Responsibility does. We monitor that through the Hanford Advisory Board. We urge people to get involved in that. Look at these sites, you know, take some interest. I took a tour of the site this past summer. It was an amazing tour. You can sign up with the Department of Energy to do that. You drive around the site. And I knew it was big, but it is huge. It's just amazing to go out there. You can actually go into the B reactor. It was declared a national monument also. And you can see what went on in the B reactor. Fermi was there, worked on the reactor. So it really is, it's amazing, but it's also horrific what they did with material that was generated at the reactor, at the whole site.
So 8 reactors not dedicated to nuclear energy, dedicated towards producing materials for nuclear weapons?
A vast majority of them were just there to produce material for nuclear weapons, produce plutonium. They got uranium from all over the United States. That's saying one thing we're going to do with the Washington Nuclear Museum and Education Center is to try to track that and look, take a look at the uranium that went into the site, where it came from, what were the consequences of mining uranium, because many of the workers, some of them Native Americans, Navajos, for example, were affected by the mining and the radioactivity that comes from the mining of the uranium ore, and then what plutonium, where that plutonium went. It went to Nagasaki. It went around the world. I'm sure some of it's sitting up in Bangor right now. A lot of it was detonated in Nevada, where they detonated over 900 nuclear weapons. So there's all this history that we're going to try to get a hold of and work with.
Well, as well as a lot of it, as you pointed out, has gone into the ground, both plutonium and the other radioactive elements.
Yes, there's a lot of plumes moving toward the river with hexavalent chromium, for example, and also with strontium. Tetrachlorine is also moved toward the river. So there's lots of issues. They're working very hard, actually, to try to have pump and treat statements to remove some of this from the groundwater. But I think the point is there is still enormous contamination. Like you said, there is a lot of plutonium that's in the ground. It's in waste ditches over there that they're trying to get a hold of and spending billions of dollars. One of the big efforts is the vitrification plant, which is behind schedule for many years. Billions and billions of dollars over cost run, where they're going to try to put into glass rods material from these tanks. And that's a really important effort, but the problem is, where do we put these glass rods? Because they just shut down the Yucca Mountain site.
Right. talk about the Green Run. Tell us what is it, and maybe Diane and Nancy, you can tell us about what, if your family was there during that time, if there was any knowledge amongst the population when it happened. So first off, what is the Green Run?
Well, the Green Run is was a major release in December 2 and 3 in 1949, where between 7,000 and 12,000 curies of iodine-131 were released into the air. And it didn't become a public, publicly known, I believe, until 1987. And it was a Spokane reporter, along with some advocacy groups, I believe HEAL, who helped press that information out. But it was done as part of a secret, what we know, but what has been released, it's been that it was a secret U.S. Air Force experiment monitoring, that had to do with monitoring Soviet equipment. Was its mission. And I think our folks had moved there about a year before that happened.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if our father would have known about this at that time. It was not anything that I remember being discussed.
My understanding is the Air Force, U.S. Air Force, did it because they wanted to figure out, they wanted to like fly through these clouds of nuclear material and see if they could monitor it, because they wanted to use the same concepts over the Soviet Union. They figured, you know, if we can measure it here, then we can do the same in the Soviet Union. And they weren't so much concerned about the ill health effects that people would have suffered.
Yeah, and those health effects are important because iodine goes to the thyroid. The thyroid uses and differentially takes up iodine, so that those radioactive iodine particles release alpha particles, so you get that cells right nearby there and potentially could cause cancer of the thyroid and thyroid cancer. So that's really important consequences of that. So the Green Run was actually, looking back on it, a horrific thing to do, because it definitely, people will take that up, animals will take that up, that material up. So it does have a lot long-term, both human and environmental consequences.
So yeah, your thyroid doesn't see a difference between radioactive iodine and table salt.
Not at all. And, you know, radiation therapy for thyroid cancer is still widely used. So if you have thyroid cancer, you have your thyroid moved, they'll often put you on a low iodine diet and then give you radioactive iodine, so it'll be differentially taken up by cells, and they'll use that as part of a therapy. But it can also be done, you know, if you have a normal thyroid and you're taking up iodine, it can move toward cancerous thyroid.
And in addition to the planned Green Run, there were other numerous releases, both into the air and into the water. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, an enormous amount. And actually, at the exhibit, Particles on the Wall, we'll have science factoids that look and specifically talk about the radiation that was released into water. Enormous amounts of millions of curies of plutonium and other radioactive particles were released into the water and into the air around Hanford. And you come to the exhibit and learn more about those things. Also, on the web, all these things, these science factoids, are there under particlesonthewall.org. You can go to that website and see both the poems, and we're going to have the visual arts posted there, as well as these science factoids.
Now, critics of, or I should say proponents of nuclear power, nuclear energy, talk about the whole concept of dilution. And they say, you know, what's the big problem? You know, you're throwing these big numbers at us, but it's going into the Columbia River and it's getting diluted. So it's really, when it's diluted like that, it's really no harm to anyone. What's the truth of that?
You know, I disagree with that. I think that, you know, some of these materials differentially taken up by other species. We consume some of those animals, for example, fish out of the Columbia River. The Columbia Reach, around where the Hanford is the last free-running part of the Columbia River, very important for salmon spawning. What you don't want is the wildlife and the food you're eating taking up these radioactive particles. Some of them have half-life that's measured in the tens of thousands of years. Plutonium, for example, has a very long half-life, so it takes thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of years for these particles to decay. If you consume those particles, they're releasing radiation, and those radiation can damage cells, and which can lead to cancer. So it's not, the solution to pollution is not dilution. We need to be able to corral this stuff, put it in glass rods, and take care of this stuff. And we need to speed up the process of cleaning up Hanford, because we don't want this stuff reaching the Columbia River, because the Columbia River flows downstream, and millions of people are dependent on the Columbia River and the food that it produces and the water that we take for drinking water.
And do you believe we actually can clean up Hanford? Because I believe people like Helen Caldicott says, you know, it's just should be turned into a major sacrifice zone.
Well, I think there's some people that are, cleaning it up is sort of, that's a tough term. What do you mean by cleaning it up? I think the best we can do is try to corral some of the material, and I think that's what they've been trying to do, is they've been tearing down a lot of the old buildings, but they put a lot of this material, gets into big lined pits now. Up until the early 2000s, they weren't even in lined pits, so this stuff, the rainwater come down, this stuff then gets into the groundwater and then flows to the Columbia River. So I think we need to do a lot more to corral this stuff. Cleaning up, I'm not so sure we can come up with what really cleaning up means.
Boy, and I've seen photos where it's not even lined pits, where it's just barrels that have been thrown out into the desert.
They just recently found an old safe that had some of the first plutonium ever produced, so sitting down in a pit. So the cleaning up is a problem. They've also had these trenches. They actually had trenches big enough to drive locomotives through. They pull these locomotives into that had high-level radioactive waste behind them, and actually just leave the whole locomotive, the whole train, in these trenches, they called them.
So, Diane and Nancy, has your family had any ill effects from Hanford that you know of?
Not that we know of.
Not that we know of. Although I don't know where one of my kids' immune deficiencies came from, but not that's a clear link.
Right. Not a direct link to health issues that we know.
You know, I think that's one of the difficult things, though. It's, you know, the effects of radiation occur 10, 20 decades later, so it's very hard to show cause and effect. Like Bill Withrop died very suddenly of myeloid leukemia. Was that leukemia a result of his growing up at Hanford? You know, we don't know what, and we can't relate the consequences of early on exposure to radioactive materials from Hanford to health consequences decades later. That's a huge challenge. And I think we have to take a precautionary approach and say, if you are there and you have some exposure to that, you have to think that your condition might be caused by that. And we should be, you know, supporting that and supporting the military people that work there and supporting others, workers there, and the potential health problems as they age.
And I was going to mention that sort of one of the other things about growing up there is the landscape. It's sort of the contradiction between some of the things that's happening at Hanford, and sort of it really is sort of a vastly beautiful landscape and river and desert there. And I think some of the visual art that will be at the Allegro sort of addresses that a little bit.
It does. The visual art in the particles exhibit ranges from landscape and riverscape to pieces that are dealing with personal issues of home and family to the issue of nuclear weaponry. Ruth Yarrow, who worked for WPSR as Hanford coordinator and made many trips to the Hanford area, has submitted a small watercolor titled View from Rattlesnake Mountain, which is a view of the desert looking toward the river and toward Hanford. I am putting a painting entitled Columbia River Late Afternoon, and this speaks about the movement and flow of water, but also about that particular river and its importance to the towns near Hanford. It's based on reflections of the Columbia River, both visual reflections in the water, but memories of the river during my childhood. And in an arid land, a source of water is always extremely important, and the Columbia River is really the heart of that area. We've also got a piece by Gail Grinnell, who was also born and raised in Richland. And her work deals with nature and also very deeply with the personal and with threads to family life. The piece that she's putting in the particles exhibit is a grid of stamped patterns depicting chalices and root vegetables, but there's an underlying layer of stacked bodies, of figures. She's really speaking about the farmers and who came and worked that land and the food that was produced. Janice Camp has submitted a piece called Site W, which is a multimedia piece depicting what is left of that old Hanford community, the school as seen through the barn walls of a lost farm. So her piece is dealing with the impact of the Manhattan Project on the people who were settlers there in the White Bluffs area before the project started. Mike Bristow is a musician and an artist who works with mixed media, incorporates found objects and photographs in his work, and his piece, Trail of Tears, has a desert theme depicting a solitary figure, possibly could be a soldier, and also incorporating the atomic symbols. And the last piece that's in the show is by T. Michael Gardner. It's entitled Yellow Cake. And this piece was inspired by the stories of the Yellow Cake Uranium, dealing with Valerie Plame Wilson and Robert Wilson, and Yellow Cake as a part of nuclear weaponry and its place in the international field.
You know, we're also going to have artifacts there, too. For example, we're going to have Bill Withrop's mother's rolling pin. And this might sound like a trivial thing, but it's actually very important because Bill wrote a couple poems about his mother's making cherry pies and baking. And this is sort of the human life stuff that went on and how the military was actually concerned about her making pies and selling them. They couldn't advertise it because they didn't want anybody to know that, I don't know whether they didn't know what Hampered existed or what, but she was not allowed to advertise her pies were for sale. So we're going to have really interesting artifacts like that. And I encourage people, if they have artifacts, we're looking for more submissions. We're going to take this site, this show on the road, so Particles on the Wall. We're going to move it to different sites. We have a site in Spokane. Auntie's Bookstore is going to be the next venue for it. We're hoping to have it at the University of Washington at Moore Hall Annex, and I encourage people to write to the University of Washington administration and encourage the University of Washington to allow us to do that. We're also looking for venues in Richland, Walla Walla, Yakima. So we're trying to reach out to take Particles on the Wall on the road and really encouraging artists of all spoken word, poems, visual artists to have submissions, submit new material for the show. So we're very excited about this.
And eventually having Particles on the Wall finally housed at the Washington Nuclear Museum and Educational Center?
Yes, that would be my fantasy.
And hopefully at,
At Moore Hall Annex, Moore Hall. Which is in sort of on the backside toward the South Campus. But like I said, it's a really, really interesting building, and the university has been determined to tear it down. But I think that hopefully we're going to save that building, turn it into a real museum. We've talked to a number of people about that. Of course, we need some money to do that. If anybody knows a nice pot of money and wants to donate that money to do this project, that'd be awesome too. But I think the blending of the arts and sciences and have this material, have artifacts, and to really show the history, I think it's very, very important history. And the state of Washington played an enormous role in the World War II and the Cold War around nuclear issues. We've had, and we mentioned plutonium being at Bangor, so we still play an ongoing history of billions of dollars going into cleanup at Hanford. Fairchild Air Force Base was involved in it, the White Train. There's just a really fascinating history, and I think we can learn a lot of important lessons if we look at that.
Now, is Moore Hall, is that accessible to people as we speak?
You know, Moore Hall Annex, it's not accessible, but you can walk up to it and look into it. You can actually look down and see where the nuclear reactor was. It's now been decommissioned sort of and decontaminated, so the building is clean, and we're hoping to install the exhibit inside. So you actually don't go into the building, but the glass walls would allow you to see the exhibit. And we're obviously, I think they would make a great physical museum where we would, you know, have artifacts there, have history, have information about use of nuclear. Like, nuclear medicine's an amazing thing, and I think for people to understand how nuclear medicine works and sort of the trade-off, we talked a little about iodine, how that works. You know, it can be both very harmful, but also has medical uses, and understand a little bit more about that. So we're hoping to make a real interesting exhibit that explores this rich history. And right now, it's all virtual. It's on our website, Washington Nuclear Museum Education Center, WAMNEC, WANMEC.org, and that's where the Particles on the Wall is also housed, and you can see all this material there.
All right, and finally, is the University of Washington receptive to turning Moore Hall into a museum?
You know, we don't know yet. We're just sort of in preliminary, talking to some other people engaged in the campus there. So we're hoping that they would be interested in doing that if we can raise the money to move that project forward. And they'll, I think it fits in perfectly with the University of Washington's mission of educating people. And I think one of the interesting things is some of the contractors are interested in this project because the aging workforce at Hanford, we need new workers over there. This problem of the radiation at Hanford, the radioactive material, is not going to go away anytime soon. And we're going to need people engaged in this issue as understanding the health effects of radiation, as well as how to manage this problem and what to do with the waste material that's still at Hanford.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, Nancy Dickman, and Diane Dickman, and they are all the co-curators of the Particles on the Wall project. And again, you have it opens tomorrow at Cafe Allegro, but you have the big reception is this next coming Friday, January 8th at 7 p.m.
Absolutely. We encourage everybody to come, enjoy the reception, and stop by Cafe Allegro.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank all three of you for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Again, talking with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, Nancy Dickman, and Diane Dickman, all co-curators of Particles on the Wall. And you can find out more at the website, particlesonthewall.org.